Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Markita Fornoff, a producer for NPR News, sitting in for Carrie Miller. I have to admit that unless I'm watching Armageddon, I spend very little time thinking about asteroids and the potential risk that they pose to our planet. But today, I'm speaking with Carrie Nugent. She's a scientist at Caltech IPAC and an asteroid hunter. She spends her days searching for new asteroids in the sky. Her new book is appropriately called Asteroid Hunters, and she joins me today from Pasadena. Carrie Nugent, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. And before anyone gets too scared, we should start off by letting them know that the planet Earth is not in any immediate peril from hazardous space objects, correct?
Not that we know of.
Yeah. The thing that really surprised me with your book is that you describe space as orderly.
Yeah. It's very interesting, especially when you're thinking about natural disasters. Natural disasters like, you know, earthquakes and hurricanes have a lot of variables to them, and that makes them very hard to predict. But asteroids themselves are relatively simple in a physics sense. They're governed by relatively simple physical equations that we understand very well and we can measure. So when it comes to asteroids, they're kind of simple, orderly systems that we can predict with high precision. And that really makes them the only natural disaster we have the technology to prevent, because we can really see where these things are going and can predict where they're going to be, you know, dozens or hundreds of years into the future.
We'll do a little bit more on that later. But now that we have everyone kind of soothed from their worries for a little bit, I think we should go back to basics and just talk about asteroids and what they are. When I was in school, they taught us that there is a clear difference between asteroids and meteorites. But that distinction's not so clear anymore, correct? Can you tell us what exactly an asteroid is?
Certainly. It's a great question. People do learn about this in school, but, you know, they really don't have a lot of cause to remember it 20, 30, 40 years down the line. So asteroids themselves are generally thought of as kind of leftover building blocks of our solar system. They're things that never quite made it into planets, and generally they're made out of rock or metal. So those are asteroids. If they've got a little bit of volatiles, things that'll heat up when they get close to the sun, like water ice or frozen carbon dioxide, CO2, those are called comets. If they have entered into Earth's atmosphere and, kind of landed on the ground and you can pick them up and hold them in your hand, they're generally called meteorites at that phase.
The line between those distinctions has kind of blurred slightly. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, the line between asteroids and comets is certainly more blurry. We find, you know, we thought that asteroids and comets were two entirely separate things. But now we're starting to find things that look a lot like asteroids but have some ice in them. Like the asteroid Ceres, or we find things that are on comet-like orbits that never have tails, and maybe they act like asteroids. So that's really kind of starting to blur these days, and that's always very exciting, right? When you start to learn new
to be
things
confused.
And challenge. Yeah, you challenge your old assumptions. So there's a lot of really exciting, great work on that kind of overlapping done by a lot of scientists around the world.
The way you described hunting for asteroids is not at all what I imagined. And so I was wondering if you could share what that process is like.
Sure. The basic method of it is relatively simple. You know, the devil is really in the details when it comes to finding asteroids. When you look through a telescope at the sky, asteroids are so small, in a cosmic sense and so far away, that they look like little points of light. They look just like stars. So the way you can find asteroids when looking at this beautiful background of stars is that you take an image of one portion of the sky, and then you wait a little bit, and then you take an image of the same portion of the sky again, so two images separated in time, and you compare them. And if there's something moving between those, the stars are all going to move slightly together, but if you see something moving in kind of a different way than the stars, that's going to be your asteroid. And that kind of basic method has been used for centuries now, starting with people, you know, looking with their telescopes and, you know, drawing images with pens, and moving now to today where we have wonderful CCD cameras, like CCDs, the technology you have in your cell phone to take pictures, and computers to look for these moving images between the stars.
Right. And you have some really, really amazing technology to do this. But I was also a little bit shocked about your comparison of one of these photos to a sonogram, like you were just looking at a blob and trying to, you know, describe a specific blob to your friend and explaining, you know, oh, that's the asteroid, clearly, whereas, you know.
Exactly.
Your friend politely nods and says, oh, congratulations.
Exactly. A lot of people think of hunting for asteroids, you know, when they learn that we look at images of space, they're picturing the images of space that they've seen, like ones from Hubble, where you have these beautiful vistas of, like, the beautiful nebulas and all the stars. And they think that's what we look at when we're looking for asteroids. But these days, you know, we do start with nice, pretty images. But when the computer will search for these asteroids, it'll zoom in on these really, really faint objects. And we're looking for asteroids that are just barely picturing, you know, coming up in our images. We're looking for the faintest things we can find. We want to find all of the asteroids that are in the image that we possibly can. So when we're looking at these things, we're just looking at these little grayscale cropped squares. They're very pixelated, and there's kind of something like vaguely fuzzy and bright in the center. And it's not terribly hard to learn how to recognize them, but it takes some practice. And it does remind me a lot of looking at a sonogram. You know, I'm sure everyone's, you know, had some friends who are expecting, and they're very excited. And they're like, we have the picture, first picture of our child. It's so beautiful. And, you know, they point to an image on the sonogram, and you're not sure, like, which fuzzy
it's a lovely
area they're
arm.
At. Yeah, exactly. And looking for asteroids is very much kind of in the same realm. But the good news for me personally is that it transfers. I've been very good at reading sonograms lately.
So well, there you go.
Now when I have friends that are expecting, I'm like, oh, right there. Oh, so pretty, you know. So it works out well.
Mm-hmm. Maybe with enough practice, your friends will get to the point where they can look at photos of asteroids, too. And know
exactly.
Immediately.
Exactly.
Yeah. You've also compared asteroid hunting to dairy farming, which I know we have a few dairy farmers in our audience, and I personally know a few of them. And I have to say, I imagine that none of them have probably ever made that comparison the other way around.
Well, full disclosure, I've never worked on a dairy farm myself, but I actually have a colleague who's an astronomer who grew up on one. And from his descriptions, they actually sound fairly similar because it's a job with constant responsibilities.
Right.
You know, if it's Christmas, you know, you still have to tend to the cows. The cows don't care that it's Christmas. The cows don't care if you're sick.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with looking for asteroids, you know. Asteroids don't care if it's Christmas. You always have to kind of maintain this data. And so I think it gets, you know, even though it's much easier work, we get to work in warmer environments than dairy farmers do. But it's still the same sort of like discipline you need to always be constantly kind of checking on this process that is going to move on independent of your own personal human life.
Yeah, science does not necessarily care about your deadlines or your human
exactly.
schedule.
Exactly. Same thing with cows.
Exactly. And you're also kind of up in the middle of the night, out on a mountain, dealing with skunks and owls while you're trying to observe what's happening in the sky, right?
Yeah. So personally, I'm very lucky. I don't have to go to mountains. The telescope I use is actually out in space. I'm mm-hmm. part of a team of scientists that uses the NEOWISE spacecraft. So this orbits the Earth. It's above the clouds, so it's always able to observe the sky. It takes a photo every 11 seconds, which is great.
It's incredible.
But I have some other colleagues, for example, colleagues at the Catalina Sky Survey, who do go up to mountains in Arizona and observe. And it's kind of the experience of being at a telescope there isn't like being a space explorer. You're kind of feeling like you're camping. You're kind of in the woods. You're surrounded by pine trees. They did have this infamous incident when a spotted skunk came into the control room and they tried to shoo it out, and then it came back in and they ended up just kind of giving up. I learned recently that they named that skunk Comet because it had outgassing events sometimes. And so they like nicknamed the skunk and like live trapped and removed it. But they do have to deal with this kind of like, you know, very, you know, in the woods area at night, very mm-hmm. quiet, very remote kind of situation when they're looking for these objects.
Okay. So knowing all of that, how do your peers in the scientific community view what you're working on? Like, is this something that other astronomers aspire to work their way up to?
Well, I think a lot of astronomers, particularly in grad school, just like any scientist, you kind of find your niche. You find what you're interested in. I don't think that any astronomers working on galaxies are, you know, envious of us. They just chose a different path.
Yeah.
It is interesting working on asteroids in particular. It offers something more tangible than a lot of other astronomical, you know, studies do. And that's personally very appealing to me. So asteroids seem like these remote celestial bodies. They seem kind of untouchable and distant and, you know, very remote from human lives, but they do impact our lives, no pun intended, when they come down to Earth occasionally. And they're also unique in that, you know, when they impact, they leave behind these beautiful meteorites. And so you can hold them in your hands. And so it's very cool to me to be able to study these objects that are so remote and so distant and celestial, and also like have a meteorite collection and be able to show these meteorites off when I give talks and, you know, just collect them and have them displayed in my own house because I'm a nerd.
I'm sure people are very impressed when they come over.
It's not that impressive a collection, but I'm very fond of it. I like my little groups of asteroids.
I guess what's the purpose of hunting for asteroids? Is it purely like to protect planet Earth from imminent doom? Are there other really important lessons that we're learning from asteroids and comets and so forth?
Well, I mean, obviously I'm biased, but I think there's, you know, hundreds of great reasons to study asteroids. Obviously, the kind of most imminent one is to prevent a natural disaster. If we were able to find all of these things and figure out their orbits, then we would know where all of the asteroids near Earth are going. We would know if one was getting close to Earth or not. And if one was getting too close, we would have the time to do something about it. That's like very important and very exciting. I also like it because it's basic space exploration. I feel like sometimes people have this mistaken notion that the whole universe has already been explored, you know, that our own solar system has already been mapped. We've sent all these, you know, we've had all these wonderful spacecraft missions photograph all the planets. That's really exciting and that's great. But I think that sometimes people think that that's like a check mark, like, oh, we're done. We've explored our solar system. And the reality of it is that we haven't even discovered most of the asteroids that are out there. So personally, I think this is a great time to be alive. It's a great time to be a scientist and be able to find these things. And then the other kind of classic reason to study asteroids is that they are very ancient. They are these leftover mm-hmm. building blocks of planets. And so they're some of the oldest material that's been unchanged, that have suffered very little changes in terms of chemistry since the beginning of the solar system. So when you look at an asteroid or when you hold a piece of an asteroid in a meteorite, you're holding something extremely old, over 4 billion years. And
wow.
That's really exciting because that helps you learn about how we got planets and how planets formed by looking at their compositions and where they are and how their composition will change depending on where they are in the solar system and trying to back out, you know, what happened and play all this kind of nice detective work like, oh, I found this mineral here. What could that mean? Mm-hmm. So there's like a lot of really kind of appealing reasons to study these objects.
Including dinosaurs, right?
The dinosaurs. Yeah, the dinosaurs. It's too bad they didn't, you know, develop telescopes or math. really helped them out. The most, you know, famous impact that happened was the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs. It's unclear if it was an asteroid or a comet, but what is clear is that it was really big and it was really a bad day for the dinosaurs. It was about 10 kilometers across. I have difficulties imagining an object that big as, you know, a small human being.
Right.
But the best analogy I've been able to come up with is that 10 kilometers is roughly 33,000 feet. And that happens to be the cruising altitude of a 747 jet. So if you're ever in an airplane or if you can imagine yourself in an airplane in a window seat, you can imagine looking out over your wing and imagining an object so large that starting on the ground, it goes all the way up and touches your wingtip. And it takes your plane a minute to fly past. It was a really, really large object. And it was coming in faster, much faster than any fighter jet. So it was a really big impact and was not a great day for all the life on Earth that day, 66 million years ago.
Yeah. And I want to backtrack a little bit because you said that we haven't found all of the asteroids out there yet. But scientists have found, is this right, over 90% of the asteroids in our solar system?
That's close to being right, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to clear that up.
Yeah.
We found over 90% of the near-Earth asteroids 1 kilometer across or larger.
Okay.
And that's great. That's a really fantastic accomplishment for humanity. We should all be real proud of that. if you're an American citizen, you can take a little bit of extra pride in that because over mm-hmm. 95% of near-Earth asteroids have been funded by NASA. So this is
wow.
really a
it's
great
warranted.
Thing America
yeah.
Yeah, has done. I mean, don't get me wrong. I would be delighted if, you know, Korea or South Africa launched their own programs to find these asteroids. But mm-hmm. so far, it's mainly been an American-funded effort.
So the asteroids that are less than a kilometer across aren't really as much to worry about?
Well, there's a second goal that asteroid hunters are working towards now, and that's to find over 90% of the 140-meter or across bigger objects. So just to put this all into context, again, the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs was 10 kilometers across, so that was really big. And we found all of the 1 kilometer across or bigger asteroids that get close to Earth. Mm-hmm. So 140 meters isn't, you know, like an extinction level serious event, but it is pretty big. It could do a lot of damage to a state or a medium-sized country. So we definitely want to find those. I think that's a priority, and it's definitely worth doing. And right now, as of the last estimate, which is a couple years old now, we've found 30% of those. So it's a really good idea to find the rest of those objects because they, you know, it's a preventable natural disaster. Why not prepare? Why not take the time to find these things now if we could do something about it, if we found one that was on a bad trajectory?
Yeah. And as I was going along in your book, I was like, you know, how do you know what you don't know? And there's a really helpful analogy that you used to describe how scientists have been able to figure out the ratio for discovered asteroids versus undiscovered asteroids. Would you mind sharing that with us again?
I can try.
You don't have it memorized?
So I think this is a really surprising thing to most people. And it's a very, you know, it's a question that makes a lot of sense. How can you possibly know what's not out there? And the way this was determined was by Dr. Amy Mainzer and her team, and they used the NEOWISE spacecraft. So the key thing about the method they used to make that determination is that it's called debiasing, and as you can imagine, it relies on not having any sort of biases in the data. Mm-hmm. So what they did is they had this spacecraft that surveyed the sky. It surveyed the whole sky out in space, the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. It wasn't affected by clouds or weather, and it could avoid the moon. So it really had a good grasp of what was going on in the solar system. And what that team did is they simulated the whole spacecraft, and they said, okay, if there were these asteroids out there, according to our incredibly complicated, precise simulation, our telescope would have seen this many, you know, some fraction of that. And then they compared that to the actual fraction they saw and kind of were able to back out what might be missing. So if here's a very simple example. So let's say in this this synthetic population of asteroids, this whole like simulated telescope, you generated 15 asteroids of a certain size and type of orbit. And if you ran those through the simulation and learned that if there were 15 asteroids out there, they would have seen 10. Then they can compare that to the actual number of asteroids of that size and type of orbit that NEOWISE did see. So if you say that NEOWISE actually saw 12, you can go back and adjust your simulation. Maybe this time you generate 18 asteroids and run that simulation again, and the simulation says NEOWISE would have detected 12 if there had been 18 out there. So if there's 18 out there and the simulation says you would have detected 12, and you actually detected 12, then the math tells you that there were 6 left that you didn't find. And that's the kind of method of determining how many were out there. Now, obviously, this is an incredibly simplistic example. You do this with much larger numbers and, you know, lots of different, you know, parameters and lots of different ways of accounting for uncertainty. But that's kind of the basic concept of how you know what you don't know when it comes to asteroids.
I want to get back to this idea of a preventable natural disaster, because you've mentioned it a couple of times. And so I want to talk about the different ways that that disaster could be prevented. So would you start with your favorite solution for handling a rogue asteroid?
I don't have like a favorite in terms of like overall.
Okay.
I think the key thing to realize is that asteroids themselves are very different from each other. And
sure.
So the particular solution would be have to be tailored on the individual asteroid. So asteroids can be made out of rock or metal, or sometimes they're these really loosely held together clumps of rock.
Mm-hmm.
Some rotate, make a full rotation, like they have an asteroid day that takes, you know, hundreds of hours. And sometimes a rotation can take 12 seconds. So, you know, your favorite solution really depends on the exact kind of flavor of asteroid you're dealing with.
So what about a loosely packed asteroid? How would we,
okay,
if that was pummeling toward Earth, what would you do to stop it?
Well, to be clear, I would not do it. I am far too low ranking to be doing anything. But The consensus of the community kind of would lean towards a probably something like a gravity tractor technique. So there's kind of three main seriously considered deflection strategies. One kind of very nice one would be a gravity tractor, where you put something in orbit around the asteroid and you use the mutual gravitational attraction between the orbiter and the actual asteroid to tug it off its course. And the thing is that you don't have to move this asteroid very much. It obviously depends asteroid to asteroid, but for a lot of these asteroids, a small change early on will have big consequences later. So you just have to tug it a little bit, and it will go on an entirely different path. So that's one really nice solution. The nice thing about that is that it's very controllable. You don't have to touch this asteroid. If it's kind of a very loosely held together pile of rock, it's kind of very unstable. The gravity's very weak, and you know, there's a lot of unknowns there. So you can kind of just slowly tug it off, which is very nice and very elegant.
And then there's also a method that involves nudging the asteroid. Can you describe that one?
Sure. And this might be more applicable to something solid, though, of course, there's a ton of variables going on. So this would be the kinetic impactor technique is what it's called. You would launch something really heavy at it and basically give it a hard shove, try to change its speed just a little bit to change its path later down the line.
And then, of course, there's always a nuclear option.
Yes. And that is actually seriously considered just because there's not a lot of sources of just a lot of energy that we have available to us. And that's one of those. So the most kind of seriously considered implementation of this would be to have a detonation next to the asteroid. Again, you'd want to give it a shove. You wouldn't want to, like, Bruce Willis drill in and blow it up. You'd want to put it nearby and give it a shove. A nuclear explosion makes for a very dramatic movie, but in reality, you know, we would want to be doing something where we precisely control all the variables and we can exactly predict what's going to happen. And the nuclear detonation, you know, there's a lot of unknowns when it comes to that. We're not exactly sure how an asteroid might react. And because of that, that's kind of a, you know, the last-ditch option. We would prefer something that's slower and more controllable if we had the time to implement that. So again, it kind of comes down to how much time the community would have to respond.
Unlike other natural disasters, it's not odd to think, like, if we had enough warning.
Right.
Because you do have a lot of warning most
of the
time. Yeah,
you could have decades. Yeah. I talked to John Giorgini, who runs JPL's Horizon system, which keeps track of every single object in our solar system, which is pretty amazing. And he said that for most asteroids, you can predict where they're going for about 80 years, which is amazing. 80 years. It's a long time. But for some asteroids where we've really studied them well, we've seen them go around the sun multiple times, we've pinged them with different techniques and really have a solid hold on their orbit, we can predict where some asteroids are going for 800 years. And that blows my mind because I can't think of anything else that we can predict for 800 years into the future. I don't know if English will be the same as it was, you know, as it is right now when we're speaking it. You know, a lot of things can change in 800 years, but even 800 years from now, you know, we'll be able to know exactly where these asteroids are going day by day. So that's kind of a pretty phenomenal capability that really just kind of blows my socks off.
That must require some intense math.
Yes, and a lot of computers.
Yeah, but there is a really human part of your job, right? Like, the way you described it, it sounds like there are certain elements that you couldn't, or I guess we just maybe haven't figured out yet how to pass them off onto a machine.
I think asteroid discovery is very characteristic of modern science in that it takes teams of people to do. This isn't, you know, one lone person, you know, super genius solving this problem. This is a lot of people working hard in teams. And then there's something really kind of nice and satisfying about working in teams to get something done. In addition, when we're trying to identify asteroids, computers will do a lot of the heavy lifting for us. They will identify things that the computer thinks is an asteroid, but the computer isn't quite as good as the human brain in finding asteroids out of this data. So the computer will kind of give us a list of candidates saying, like, I think these might be asteroids. And then we actually go through that kind of small list and look at them, each one, with our own human eyes and our human brains and say, like, ah, that one's a good one. Oh, sorry, computer, you got that one wrong. And we're obviously developing, you know, working hard to develop our computer techniques to make the computers better and better. But when it comes down to it, you know, the final kind of go-ahead is usually a pair of human eyes on the screen saying, yep, that's a new asteroid.
And human eyes from all over the world.
Yeah, the Minor Planet Center is a really interesting place. It's a global archive of every single asteroid observation that's ever been made. Anybody can submit their observations of asteroids to there. You don't have to be, you know, a professional scientist. You do have to pass a small test to make sure you're doing your job right. But anyone with a telescope, you know, and enough dedication can do that without a problem. So it takes observations from all over the world. It archives them, and it also determines orbits for these asteroids. And it's pretty cool. If you go onto their website, which I would actually recommend, it's www.minorplanetcenter.net. You can see the statistics of how many asteroids have been discovered as of the day you're looking at it, which is pretty fun. So I happened to check this for today, and today is August 1st. And so far this year, a little over halfway through this year, we found 936 near-Earth asteroids, making an all-time total of 16,438 near-Earth asteroids found. If you want to know how many minor planets we found, including asteroids and comets, as of this year, there have been 17,827 discoveries. That's just this year. And for an all-time total of 734,274. So a lot. And I really like seeing that number go up. It's very satisfying to me. You know, even if I don't, you know, discover a new asteroid one day, I like seeing that my colleagues did. You know, we're always ticking that number up just a little bit and working towards solving this problem.
Reporting your data to other scientists around the world is one of your rules of being an asteroid hunter. Do you want to talk about your other rule?
Sure. I mean, there's no like hard and fast rule. It's not like you go to asteroid hunting school and they're like, rule one. I just thought it was kind of a neat framework for kind of explaining how this is done. Mm-hmm. So one rule is don't look at the sun. if you look at if you look at a sun with a telescope, it's bad news. Usually it's real bad for your telescope. It might be bad for your eyes if you're actually looking through the eyepiece. And the fact that you can't look at the sun has some surprising consequences. I think that sometimes people think that you can just kind of, well, if you were to observe asteroids for a year, you could just find all of them and then you could just be done. And that would be great. And although I wish that was true, that's not actually the case, because the sun will always make half of the sky, the half of the solar system, invisible to us with ground-based telescopes. We're not able to look there. And so depending on how the asteroid and the Earth and the sun are all kind of, you know, relative to each other as the asteroids and the sun as the asteroids and the Earth orbit the sun, you can be hard to see some asteroids over some period of years, because they'll always be kind of in the daytime half of the sky. And it's kind of an interesting consequence. And this is part of the reason why we've needed to hunt for asteroids for, you know, there's been kind of modern efforts for the last decades that have been very successful, but it's still taking a while to find these objects. And that's why we find new ones all the time.
Which is part of why it's really important, right, to have worldwide asteroid hunters, so that then you have people who can't look into the sun and check for asteroids, but then you have other people who can look in areas that you can't and keep the work moving forward.
That's right. So the five major asteroid surveys are funded by the U.S., and these are mostly either in Hawaii with Pan-STARRS or in kind of the southwestern U.S., excluding NEOWISE, which is out in space in a special case. But as the Earth turns, sometimes you want to do follow-up. So these discoveries will be made usually with one of those surveys, but not always. And then they will put it on the Minor Planet Center's webpage and say, like, can somebody else look for these objects and keep an eye on them? And then you'll have observers all over the world chipping in and finding these objects and reporting their observations and, you know, keeping an eye on these things, which is really, really lovely. It's a nice, really nice system.
Explain a little bit more about why it's so fortunate that we do have NEOWISE as an asset to us. Like, what does that enable you to see that we can't see from, say, Hawaii or Arizona or somewhere like that?
Well, NEOWISE has the advantage of, you know, as I said, being out in space. So mm-hmm. we don't have to worry about clouds. That's great. We see the whole sky. So we orbit the Earth in a sun synchronous orbit. So we kind of go over the poles, basically, around the Earth. Mm-hmm. And so we see the southern hemisphere. And there's not any other major asteroid survey looking for asteroids in the southern hemisphere. So that's a big advantage. The other big advantage of NEOWISE is that we see the sky in the infrared. Instead of the reflected light that you see off asteroids with visible light that you can see with your eyes, we're seeing the heat that comes off the asteroids. And that's really nice for a couple of reasons. The first one is that some asteroids are incredibly dark in color. They can be as dark as printer ink, as dark as coal. So really, really dark. Mm-hmm. And if you're a really, really dark asteroid, you don't reflect a lot of visible light. And it's kind of hard to see with ground-based telescopes that use reflected light. But if you look at the heat that this very dark asteroid emits, it glows very brightly. So we can find dark asteroids. That's a big advantage. The other advantage is that we can measure the sizes of asteroids. So because asteroids can be very dark or they can be much lighter in color, if you're just looking about how much light they reflect, you don't know if it's very small and very shiny and very light colored, or if it's very big and very dark. And so you can have a lot of uncertainties in sizes. If you ever kind of see these news reports where they find a new asteroid and they're like, it could be, you know, between 10 and 40 meters in size. You're like, that's not, you know, you can see
it's not a very helpful range. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a big unknown. You'd really like to know better than that. But that's why, because they don't know whether it's very tiny and reflective or really big and really dark. And so they have to give you these big uncertainties. If you can see an asteroid in the infrared, though, you can the amount of heat it emits is directly proportional to its size. A small thing will emit less, heat, and a big thing will have more heat. So because of that, you can back out the size a little bit better. And that gives you kind of this fundamental constraint and lets you know how big these things are, which is really useful. I last calculated this last year, I believe, only about 1 in 5 asteroids have a measured size. So in addition to not knowing most of the asteroids out there, we also don't know how big most of them are. There's really like fundamental quantities that we want to know about these objects.
Science is a very competitive field. Let's talk a bit about the balance between kind of competing with other scientists to publish first, but also the need to share data in order for things to move forward.
So I would say that the asteroid community kind of has a unique solution to this problem, and that's because the Minor Planet Center acts as an archive for all asteroid and comet data. When you discover a new asteroid, you don't have to write a paper about that and get to the, you know, publisher first. Instead, you will submit the asteroid you found and the location, the sky you found it, and how bright it was to the Minor Planet Center, and they kind of take care of it. And so in the same sense, your discovery is made public very quickly, you know, within hours or less time, maybe even minutes. It's put on the internet. It's public. But you're also kind of giving credit for your discovery. So the release of information is very transparent, which is very important for the community, because if you find a new object, you want other people in, you know, on planet Earth to look for it. People in other countries, people where it's, you know, daytime or people in other countries where it's nighttime, where it's daytime for you, or different hemispheres. So in that sense, the sharing of data is kind of very baked in to the asteroid community.
What is the state or the health of funding in the U.S. for programs like yours today?
That's a really great question. And, you know, obviously things change very quickly in Washington these days, and I'm not up to date on that. But I do think that finding asteroids is a priority. It is a priority that several congresspeople recognize, which we are deeply, deeply grateful for. And we are also lucky that this is a nonpartisan issue. It's something that people on both sides of the aisle can agree on, which is really lovely. So, you know, we are watching the budget extremely closely, and I really do hope that there is funding for our work in that budget. But, you know, we'll have to see. There is a lot going on in Washington, so we'll have to see how it all pans out. But I do hope that people recognize that this is an important issue and divert a small amount of funding towards us to fix it.
There are very few things that are nonpartisan these days, and it's very nice that there's at least one.
I think this is something that we can all agree on, that we should really find the asteroids before they find us.
Carrie Nugent, thank you so much for sharing your data and your background with us this morning. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. It was lovely talking to you.
Carrie Nugent is the host of Space Pod, and her new book is called Asteroid Hunters. She joined me today from Pasadena. You're listening to NPR News.